This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect our office's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in these three fields, all in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on the current trends and issues facing the Garden State. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Hi, my name is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. On May 15th, our office held its second annual domestic terrorism conference, where we brought together law enforcement, intelligence, and academic professionals to discuss the topic of domestic terrorism and its presence in our communities across the country and internationally. The series of podcasts you're about to hear are interviews with many of those featured speakers who were there that day. We hope you find them interesting and as informative as we did. Hi, my name is Dean Barada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. And for today's podcast, we're joined by Dr. Alexander Hitchens. He is the research director of the Program on Extremism at the George Washington University. Prior to joining the Program on Extremism, Dr. Hitchens was the head of research at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization and a lecturer on terrorism and radicalization at the War Studies Department in King's College London. An expert on extremist movements, he has researched and conducted fieldwork on jihadist groups in the United States, United Kingdom, East Africa, and Iraq, with a focus on how they attract recruits. So, Dr. Hitchens, today we were talking to you a little bit about something a little different from jihadist movements. We were talking about sort of the far right in Europe and something called the counter-jihadist movement. Could you tell us a little bit about what exactly that is?
Yeah. So in a way, related to the jihadist movement, in that they are essentially this kind of reaction to, you know, over a decade of sort of terrorism post 9/11 in Europe and America. And it's largely this kind of mixture of a sort of disaffected white working class in Europe who feel that the mainstream politicians are not doing enough for them generally, politically, and we see that, you know, more widely, but also not doing enough against terrorism, because they think that really the key problem is not ideology or politics, that it is purely Islam and Islam only as the threat. And, you know, any Muslim in Europe or America is a potential terrorist. And they'd like to see politicians to cut the sort of PC language and come to the heart of the issue and get tougher on Muslims more widely. This is the only way that they see they can be sort of protected. And they believe essentially in this sort of conspiracy that's taking place called what they call the Islamization conspiracy, the Islamization project, where they see Muslims all over the United States and Europe involved in politics or involved in other types of movements who they believe are part of this wider plan to sort of take over the West by undermining Western values, undermining the political system with the long-term goal of establishing an Islamic state. And they see the mainstream politicians, again, as either not doing anything about it because they're too politically correct or as actually in on the conspiracy because they have personal, you know, financial perhaps gain or because they're just scared.
Now, one of the groups that I guess sort of typifies that philosophy is a group called the English Defense League. Do groups like that have specific goals they're looking for, specific objectives? In this case, with the English Defense League, how does the UK sort of look at a group like that? Is it viewed as an extremist group? Is it a mainstream political group or something else?
So the English Defense League was one of the first versions of the counter-jihad movement that was very much based on street activism, on street protests. And it was mobilizing this population of disaffected British working class people, essentially representing, you know, saying to them that we're here to represent your concerns and no one else is doing. We're out here, we're fighting, you know, we're out on the street fighting. They have to see people doing, you know, and in their sense, these guys are out there doing, they're out there outside a mosque, you know, protesting that mosque. And for them, that was a very sort of powerful way of operating, especially for people who are not politically engaged, politically active. They like to see just action, and this was very attractive. See, the UK has a long history of far-right street movements, most of them being of the sort of skinhead, white nationalist, neo-Nazi variety, National Front, Combat 18 in the 80s and 70s as reactions to immigration of South Asian immigrants who would, you know, they would be quite violent, they would intimidate, they would beat up minorities, they would, you know, vandalize stores, things like that. So when the EDL came along, again, it was the same type of population, white working class, disaffected, who were, you know, targeting a minority, who were, you know, showing bigoted views. And so when they emerged, they were essentially just seen as the newest version of a long history of far-right activism and movements. And to some extent, they were that. But they were also, you know, groups of people who didn't see themselves as racist, who, if you told them they were racist, would be very offended, or who hated Nazis in many cases. They say, you know, we didn't, you know, we fought these guys in World War II. Why would we, you know, be Nazis? But what they don't realize is often that they're taking on views that really have at their core the same type of divisive and essentialist, you know, message, be it not racial, but more cultural and religious.
So it's kind of interesting when you say they wouldn't consider themselves racist. And I think when we think of white nationalists, white supremacists, we think of individuals who sort of hate the whole spectrum of people who are unlike them. But groups like the ADL seem to at least be more accepting of some other cultures or religions, whether it's Judaism or LGBT. And their focus is kind of focused on Islam. Is that correct?
Yeah. And that's a tactic too. That's to get as much people involved as, or as many people involved as they can. And I think there's an element of cynicism, but there's an element of truth to it. You know, they're kind of post-racist in the sense they're not defining their culture purely by race in the way that a white nationalist does. Yes, they'd like to see most of the country be white, definitely. But they're not saying, you know, the definition of our nation is a white nation. They may say things like we are a nation that has Christian or Judeo-Christian values, that we, therefore Islam has no place. They often say that, you know, Islam is the anti-liberal idea. They'll say that Islam is anti-gay, that Islam is anti-women, that Islam is anti-Semitic. And they'll present themselves as a reaction. They'll say we're trying to protect Western values by, you know, stopping the so-called spread of Islam or the Islamization. So when you hear it just like that, you can see how some people may find themselves getting involved. Say, yeah, I'd like to see someone to be a bit tougher on this stuff, cut the PC talk, and kind of get to the issue while preserving values. But, you know, in the end, you know, the more you analyze and the more you look at these groups, you can't deny that there is an essential sort of bigotry to what they're saying. They're not allowing space for any type of Muslim to exist. They're essentially saying that all Muslims are a threat. You know, they're raping women, they're killing people, that, you know, terrorism and jihadism is hand in hand with Islam. All Muslims support, you know, 9/11, things like this, that they're outbreeding us is another big theme, that, you know, Muslims are intentionally having more kids in Europe so they can all outbreed us. That kind of talk, really, if you were to just replace Muslim with Jew or Black or, you know, whatever, it just sounds like the good old fashioned, you know, far-right extremism that we're used to. So it has got at its core a lot of that bigotry in it still.
Now, with the attacks we've seen in Europe since 2015 and the refugee crisis that we saw after that, what impact has that had on the counter-jihadist movement in Europe?
It's helped it very much, because for the guys who've been involved in it for a long, long time, they're saying, you know, we warned you about this. See, this is coming, because you still don't do anything about it. It's just getting worse. And now you're telling us we've got to take in all these Muslim refugees. Not only will they be a security threat, but they're a cultural threat. They're going to come in and they're going to change our culture. It's all going to be done very quickly. So it has assisted them. And the attack, every time there's an attack, you know, more and more people will listen to them. And it's also helped them get more involved in politics. So we've seen political parties, from Marine Le Pen's party in France, sort of at its core, again, a white nationalist party, to the Dutch Freedom Party in the Netherlands, the UK Independence Party in England, European sort of right-wing anti-immigrant parties taking on a lot of the same ideas as the EDL and the counter-jihad movement, who's seeing Islam in that same light and finding an audience for it. And, you know, one of the lessons that the Europeans are learning the hard way, and to some extent the Americans, is that if you don't deal with these issues as the mainstream, if we don't have no discussion about immigration, we have no discussion about Islam, even in this sort of in a mainstream sensible way, someone else is going to do it. And people want to hear this discussion. People want to hear, okay, what is the relationship between Islam and terrorism? To just tell everyone that there is no relationship, there's no discussion to be had, is not convincing. We need to be, you know, more serious about that discussion. How much immigration is too much? Is there such thing? Am I allowed to even have a problem with, you know, mass immigration into Europe? Can we discuss it? Mainstream parties for far too long in Europe have refused to even touch these subjects and have pushed away everyone who wants to talk about them. And essentially, they've pushed away a big chunk of their population, which is essentially a white working class population, who have borne the brunt of these types of policies, who are now really kind of open to whoever comes and claims to speak for them. My point really here is that if the mainstream political parties don't deal with these issues, other people will come and do it. And then we have a real problem, because then you have people who don't share our values, who are not open, liberal, democratic or actors, who are getting influence among a population of people who we have thrown to the side because we've told them they're racist or they're backward and we're not engaging with them. And this helps explain the rise of far-right politics in Europe particularly, if you ask why did Marine Le Pen, you know, come close to becoming the president of France, or, you know, why is the far right doing so well in Hungary, or even in the UK, and why did Brexit happen, all this stuff. Big chunks of it have to do with the fact that the mainstream political parties didn't address concerns of a chunk of their population who are now voting for whoever claims to talk for them. And that's been a hard lesson that we're learning.
It's kind of interesting as I hear you say that. I think that groups like Al-Qaeda, groups like ISIS have been pushing a narrative saying that telling Muslims who live in Western countries, hey, all this sort of coexistence is nonsense. It's a war of us versus them. You have to pick a side. And it seems like this counter jihadist movement is essentially saying the same thing. And I wonder how much they need each other to perpetuate this. And then the other part that comes to mind is, just like you said, the white working class sort of didn't have a space to talk about these issues. It sounds like they're crowding out any space for Muslims to talk about these issues in those countries as well, right? If they're getting pushed out of the conversation, then are we likely to see a counter movement?
Yeah. So what you referred to there is what has been termed reciprocal radicalization, or they call cyclical, radicalization, which, yeah, is this idea that these two movements, they need each other. They're the different sides of the same coin. And there is something to that. Absolutely. As I said, the EDL itself originally emerged as a direct response to a British jihadist street movement that wasn't illegal. It wasn't breaking the law. It wasn't terrorist, but it was supportive of jihadism, and it would take to the streets and march against Britain and for, Al-Qaeda and say they want to create Britain, Islamic State in Britain. These guys reacted to that. And if you look at their propaganda, they use each other all the time, of course. And they say, whereas when there's a terrorist attack, the EDL or groups like them will say, this is the representative of, your average Muslim in Europe is this terrorist. And the Muslim organizations will take a group like the EDL or others and say, this is the representation of what the West is. This, they're turning against you. And they basically make each other look a lot bigger and more influential than they really are, because they need that. They need that to perpetuate their narrative that, these two cultures or these two, movements are at war with each other. So, yeah, they're absolutely very, very reliant on each other.
So there's certainly been some controversy about immigration and refugees here in the U.S. as well. I don't think to the same extent as Europe, but are there lessons from Europe that we could or should be applying here, or is it a different situation?
I think it's very different. So there's a couple of things here. Firstly, Europe is much closer to these conflict zones, so it's going to have bigger numbers of people come over. Secondly, a lot of these European countries very much need this immigration for their economies that are in need of labor, of just, perhaps unskilled even labor. The other kind of big issue here is that Europe, it essentially has open borders. There's something called the Schengen zone in Europe, which means that once you're in the Schengen zone, you can move around all these countries pretty much freely without needing passport or any sort of ID or anything like that. Imagine going around the continental United States without needing to ever show any sort of ID. They're doing that within nations in Europe. Mm-hmm. And that is, that means that people can move around, the wrong type of people can move around very easily. And so this has kind of been linked with immigration, essentially, because they're saying that people can come to all these huge groups of immigrants can come into one country and that doesn't perhaps have very good security checks, usually in Eastern Europe, like, or Southern Europe, like Greece or Italy. And through there, they can then travel through the rest of Europe without being checked. And so the idea is, within this big group of immigrants, you've got people who are hiding as, who are pretending to be immigrants, who are actually, ISIS or whatever, very easily moving around. So this then means that people want to see a full reaction to all immigration, shutting it down for those few that are hidden inside. That's not really a relevant issue for the U.S. Getting to the U.S. takes years of checks. Each person, no matter what, the checks are huge. The travel is completely different. So from a security standpoint, there's no comparison. Europe does have a security issue there. The U.S. doesn't. And the numbers are just nowhere comparable. I think that Germany took 100,000 a couple of years ago now from Syria and around there. Those numbers don't even come close to the kind of the fairly small numbers the U.S. takes. So I think, it's a geographic issue in the end. The Europeans are much closer. Americans are much further away.
And then lastly, for listeners who might be interested in this topic, do you have any recommendations, readings, authors, researchers, anything at all?
Yeah. So for the European context, there's a few. One of the best, a guy called Roger Griffin. He's a professor at Oxford Brookes University. A guy called Matthew Goodwin, a very good researcher on it. Generally, there are a number of organizations that are very useful to look at. RUSI in London is a very important think tank that looks at these things. And sort of more widely, the kind of more intellectual discussions. Christopher Caldwell has written a book called Reflections on the Revolution in Europe. which I recommend. As you know, it's a controversial book, and it may have some views that people might have problems with, but it's a good examination of the issue.
Excellent. Dr. Hitchens, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.